Professor Peter Goodrich is the, what you might call, the doyen of studies in law and humanities. He's professor of law and director of law and humanities at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York. He was also the founding dean of the Department of Law, Birkbeck College, University of London, where he was the Corporation of London professor of law. Largely as a result of his efforts, these two institutions have been at the forefront of the global flourishing of law and humanities scholarship over the last 20 years. In the UK and US respectively, these institutions have provided a home, support, and critical encouragement for scholarship which has fused continental philosophy, jurisprudence, and the cultural study of law with a distinctive blend of imagination, daring, and scholarly rigor. In the forming of these institutions and the building of this unique law and humanities scholarly tradition, the influence of Professor Goodrich's work has been incalculable. He has written extensively in the areas of law and literature, legal philosophy, English legal history, and semiotics. His many books include Languages of Law, Law in the Postmodern Mind, Law in the Unconscious, Nietzsche and Legal Theory, Derrida and Legal Philosophy, Law, Text, Terror, and the Laws of Love. Please join me in welcoming Peter Goodrich.
I like the idea of having an incalculable effect. It reminds me of an inscription on a book I wrote once to a friend saying, "Nothing could describe the help that you gave me." He interpreted that quite literally as meaning that nothing could and nothing would. So it's great to be here. Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you to Des, who's not here, giving us space, perhaps. And thank you to Lee and to Paul. So I'm going to talk about three things, all related to the visual, the ironic, the legal, and the emblematic. I'm going to start with an empirical irony about the power of the image in the dispersion and the dissemination of law. I'm going to move to a project, the visiocratic project of law historically, and try to use that, and specifically the tradition of legal emblem books, of pictures that were incredibly popular, produced by lawyers from 1531 to about 1700, beginning with Alciato and the Emblematum Liber. And then finally, I'm going to talk about a satirical critical reprise. In other words, what does one do with this? How does one work with images? How does one use visual advocacy, which is the flavor of the day, where the big money is, IRL, and in real life? And so the question there is to try to revive the tradition in a thoughtful, critical, and radical manner, and I'll do that by looking at something I know best, which is law schools. Anyway, I don't want to detain you too long. You've had 3 days of this. This is the feminine ending, but I'm not very feminine, but I will show pictures, so maybe that can qualify me in a little bit. So let me start with an empirical study recently published, a study conducted at New York University School of Law, which is a top five, no, number six law school in the US of A, which is of incredible importance in the self-propagation of the legal academy. So this is really hot. And the first year of law school, like most JD programs, involves training in the law of contract, in the law of administration, elements of constitution, elements of tort, and also a year-long course in lawyering skills. And lawyering skills is what we would call elements of the legal system, elements of legal method. But the purpose of this, outside of the doctrinal subjects, is to teach you how you interpret the reasoning of cases as something specific to lawyers, as a reasoning of its own, as a system of precedent that produces rules, as opposed to reading it as literature or as romance or as some strange species of hoarding, according to the session we were just at. So The first year of law school is designed to teach both the substance and the technical skills of lawyering. At the end of the first year lawyering course, the students are sent to argue a case in court. The researchers decided to divide the students into two groups. One group was sent to a formal courtroom with bench, bar, throne, with murals, with portraits, with Latin inscriptions, and a judge in robes. The other group, randomly selected, was sent to the series of moot courtrooms and classrooms that had been reorganized into courtrooms, and they appeared before judges in everyday garb. What does the study reveal? Study reveals that the students who argued in the formal courtroom, under the columns, under the architecture, under the bar, below the bench, in front of the judge in robes, believed that the decision was more just, the judge was more authoritative, and there was greater legal reason to the determination than those students who appeared in the reorganized moot courtroom before the judge in everyday wear. So the question is, why is it that the students, having been trained precisely to ignore the dimension of theater, the aesthetic of ornament, the irrelevance of the merely apparent, who'd been trained in the line, rod, and compass of legal reason, were nonetheless so influenced by the regalia, by the maiestas or majesty, by this appearance of authority? And I'm a generous person, I won't keep you waiting. The answer is that they misrecognized the situation, but they had an intuition. And that intuition was that what they were perceiving, what was apparent in the dress and the costume and the ritual, was faith, was justice, which is a species of faith, not of law, authority, which is something that you love, not something that you find through the concatenation of ratiocinations that the elements course had taught. So the question, though, is what did they see? Because they didn't see men in dresses. Or maybe in a Freudian sense they did. Maybe the straightforward answer would be they were Oedipal. Hate the man, love the dress. But I think that there is probably more to it than that. There was an accuracy to the perception. There was a significance to what they saw that needs to be reconstructed patiently and can be discovered, interpreted, thought through in terms of law's traditional relationship to the visual. And we have an entire archive that details how lawyers see. We have an entire archive of pictures of norms produced by lawyers, the legal emblem tradition that began in 1531 accidentally, but what isn't an accident, when Alciatus sent his book of aphorisms based upon Erasmus's apothegms, and the publisher added images. And from that tradition, from 150 to 200 years of legal picture books, legal emblem books, one can get a sense of the irony of the visual and of what it is that one sees, what it is that those hungry for law, and remember that these are young students, impressionable students at the end of their first year, see in this rite and in this architecture and art. So first off, if we go back to this tradition and try to think of the results of that empirical study in relation to the legal tradition of both portraiture, but more importantly of emblem book, this printed theater, as it was called, Theatrum Imprimata, then we can start with the irony of the tradition. And here we have Cousteau's Pegma, And In Saturum, so it's in Latin, titled Pegma, is fantastic. Pegma is the architectural device that brings players onto the stage in the theatre. And it's also, in the digest, used as a term for the shelf where you keep the images. And the images are the masks of the ancestors, the imago, that rule the household. So already we have a sense in Pegma of what it is that these emblem books are going to do. And Cousteau is a lawyer and a humanist lawyer and part of significant in the Mens Emblematica, this humanist tradition of law. So what does he show here? He shows a satire, so already an ambivalence. This is about satire, but it's also a satire that is being shown. And the satire is a warning against those who desire to know too much too soon, against armchair philosophers, basically, and they get burned. Here, the satyr is attempting to kiss the flames, enamored like Prometheus with this newfound fire of knowledge here, and of course gets burnt. But then you have to look closer at the framing, and you will see further satires, lutes, music, which I'll come to in a moment, and at the bottom, the Beelzebub-like figure that has strings coming out of its eyes that attach to and hold on to the figures here. Normally it's the tongue that is shown as pulling people with thongs because you can't escape the power of rhetoric. But in fact, it's the power of the visual that we see here, and it's the eyes. It's the visual line, as I'll explain it in a moment, should I have time, that is dragging the people along. So the point seems to be twofold, and I'm using this as being somewhat emblematic, that the visual has a power to bind, the visual has a power to capture and to drag along, at the same time that the visual will burn, will exceed, will taunt, and will consume those who do not understand properly how to look. Here, the theater of good engines, of good devices, heraldic term, Guillaume Perrier from 1544, just another example of the same thing. But you see here at the bottom, the whole thing with the emblem is it is presented as a printed stage. And at the very bottom of the book, it's just one of many examples. You can actually see a stage. Well, you can't, you're sitting too far back. Like my students, no one in the first row, I notice. You'd see much better if you came closer. But you have a couple of lovers. You have a paschal lamb as well. You have a lute. And this is self-consciously on a stage with theatrical backing. So that's the context of the rite. That's the context of the theatre. Theatrum justitia et veritatis et justitia. The theatre of justice and truth that at the same time as the emblems were being written has been the subject matter. What the students more likely saw was a version of In Senatum Boni Principis, this image of justice, which you'll often see outside the courtroom as well. And here we have it in a nicely Art Deco version, not the first edition of the Emblematum Libellus, but a second edition in Paris. Oh, Lord, wrong thing, anyway. So all of the obvious context, emblem 143, the lawyers and the theologians to left and right, and no hands, les mains coupées. And the reason I picked this particular instance was the prince, who is here quite self-evidently blindfolded. And I think 1536 is the first time that in an emblem book we have a blindfold, because usually the image is, and this is actually one from the first English vernacular emblem book, Thomas Palmer's 200 Poozies, but also an emblem book. And you can't see in these that the king, the prince, is blind. The eyes are gouged out. But while the truncated hands are evident, the blindness of the king had to be presented through the use of a bandage, a blindfold, in later work to make it clearer, although if you read the accompanying text, it refers you back to Greek and to Egyptian hieroglyphs, and the source usually given is Plutarch, and it refers to statues in Thebes where the judges are shown handless so that they don't accept bribes, and the judges are shown blind to indicate that they neither favor nor fear those that come before them. That's the traditional representation. That probably is some version of the prior concept of justice that we have. That's probably some version of why the students saw Incitatum Boni Principis or the regalia and the maestas as being more important than the ordinarily or civilian dressed judge in a less regal surrounding. Note the curtain behind the judge, the throne, and note also that it's the prince, that this is a political image. So we're not really talking about law, although it's in front of every law court, it's a political representation. And it's a political representation, and here I want to move a little bit to the irony that lies behind this, behind being burnt by the image, being burnt by the emblem, which is that it's also heavily satirical in origin. Just note, eyes gouged out, hands cut off, not going to be much use rhetorically, chironomically, or in any other form in that heavily damaged measure. So we have it here again in Peachum, and I just draw your attention to Justitia Symbolum, that these are symbola, and symbola has a very particular meaning for the 16th and the 17th century lawyers. It takes you back to Plutarch and the hieroglyphs, this knowledge that the populace cannot have, this knowledge that will destroy those who try to get to it in some imperite form. Here you have the Theban myth again, and that is the explanation of the dress, but truncated and eyes gouged out again. Symbolum is defined as a image that conceals. It's actually literally defined as a synecdoche. In other words, a symbol is the tip of a much greater truth. The symbol is the Latin version of the hieroglyph, an esoteric form of knowledge, an enigma juris, a legal enigma that refers to forgotten texts or forgotten histories. And so here we get a sense of the ambivalence and the complexity of the image of justice, that it is far from being simply a representation of how this is truer, more legal, more just, and more fair than the other possible procedures. Now, it's relatively well known that Brandt in The Ship of Fools has an image of a clown blindfolding Justitia. It's been written about a considerable amount. All I would point out is that if you look at the text, it's precisely concerned with fools, with the imperite, with non-lawyers, with citizens who uselessly waste the time of the court with petty disputes. And then at a second level, it's about the lack of wisdom, the turn to a debased modernity amongst those who don't pay proper attention to the Prisca Jurisprudentia, to the classical tradition and to the Roman texts. Local law, common law, if you like, leave it alone. It simply blinds the judge and makes a mockery of justice. And Brandt is writing, and the woodcut is being produced around 1494, just slightly after we get a very similar version. This is esoteric, but I can't stop myself, from the trainer, the studio master, Wulgemot, that Dürer trained with. And Wulgemot in a sketchbook has pictures of the mocking of Christ. And Christ has his eyes gouged out and his hands cut off. And it's an image of a terrible mistake in Christian theological terms. It's an image not of justice, it's an image of a disaster. It's an image of the fall of the human, not of the justice of the legal. And we can see that again in Perrier, Morosophie, the philosophy. Amazing book. Again, Perrier, a lawyer. Why aren't we writing books with titles like that now? It's based on the Encomium Mori, or the title is, the Praise of Folly. But look at this for an explanation of the blindfold on Justitia. Justitia, head in the clouds amongst the divine, in nature at least, reading a book, eyes fully open, hand in the rhetorical position of delivery, toga that is almost a form of angelic wings. And then beneath the pedestal, we see the lawyers. They're all blindfolded. They're all stumbling around. They're all cupidinous, as you can see from the little Cupid. So they have to learn, in a sense, not to see. They have to learn to listen. They have to learn to begin in the interior. And here we have the author of the first book on legal imagery, the Tractatus de Insignibus et Armis, Bartolus of Saxo Ferrata. The image is from 1566. The book was about 1358. But if we're talking about blindfolded lawyers, if we're talking about the meaning of the obscuring of vision, then think of this portrait, this emblem of the emblematic, because the emblematic grows out of the heraldic tradition. It grows out of a genealogical representation of nobility and of denitia dignitatum, of the places of office, these spectacular modes of presentation so we can see without having to know the language or without having to talk to the people what the administrative occasion and what the place is. So the author of the first book ever on legal signs, on legal vision, is portrayed basically blind. This is not a dude that you would ask directions from, because he is looking right down, covered eyes, downcast eyes, and the message clearly, along with the cowl and the representation of his religious habit, is that you don't look towards the law. You don't look towards justice. And Paul was talking about it earlier, the limit on vision. And here, very, very directly, very rigidly, you see the limit on vision, that the jurist is not sufficiently great. The jurist is not sufficiently important to see the law. The law, indeed, as the truncated hands should suggest, should be asharo-poetic. The strongest image is the image that no hand has ever touched, the image that the divine impresses without human intervention. And here the closest that you can get to that is internally and reading the law that's inscribed in the heart, reading the law that is unwritten, reading the law that cannot be seen. So the irony that I want to draw from this is twofold. Number one, the most obvious thing, and I'll come to this in a moment, is that far from being a representation of justice, the blindfold, the gouging out of the eyes, the amputation of the hands, the burning of the satyr, are images that effectively are saying, keep out. In other words, come in, but come in on very specific and predetermined terms. Come in, but you cannot look at what you see. What you see has to be something that isn't visible. You have to learn, in other words, to appreciate something that isn't there, which is the definition of faith. Faith is belief in what has no being and is invisible. Faith is belief in what is not. All of the common law tradition, very clear on that. And I mention that simply because that's my tradition. So here you have an image that predates Hobbes's Sovereign and the frontispiece of Leviathan. Mendo, 1642, Book of Emblems. Hominum regimen deus possit. Men need gods to lead them. human regimen, human governance requires divinities. They have to learn to follow. And here you have this beautiful image. All of these prostrate, crawling figures, crawling up the hill towards Leviathan, towards incorporation after death into this great spectral body, no doubt, and being guided by Mercury. And Mercury, of course, is the one who can listen to the gods. Could be no clearer representation of what it is that the legal emblem tradition, in a very profound sense, is trying to portray to these young lawyers. So what is it the regalia shows you? What is it that you learn from this visual depiction of good governance? And you learn, effectively, a lesson of obedience. These are instances of the finger post. If you want to talk in the language of Francis Bacon, one time Lord Chancellor of England, fired, but all the better and nobler for that. He got to write other and more interesting books, including the Novum Organum, and the Novum Organum talks about finger posts, which is what Mercury will point out to and direct these poor lame individuals towards, in some sense, and then if they study well, maybe these Cupida Juventus Legum can come to do it themselves, play the role of Mercury if they get good degrees at McGill Law School or whatever. And so the task is a training to appreciate signs that are already there, which is precedent, of course, but precedent that goes back to nature and nature that goes back to divinity. What's Bacon's definition of the finger post? It is instantias crucis. These are instances of the cross in the Latin text, which then gets translated into instances of the finger post. The lawyers are cruce signati, bearers of the cross, people who witness, understand, can read, see the cross. And again, his claim in the Novum Organum is to aim for simple sensuous apprehension. But what's his example? His initial example is of an obelisk. And what if people needed to move an obelisk? Well, you couldn't have any greater image of governance and of hieroglyphs. Every book of symbolic forms, every dictionary of symbols, sacred and secular, begins with a title page with two obelisks, and they have Egyptian hieroglyphs down both sides, and then you have a whole series of Latin definitions, etc., etc. Any number of them. Ripa's Iconologia is probably the most famous example, though I have many others, too tedious to bore you with. So here's the thesis, that there is a visiocratic regime. The visiocratic regime has to extend itself and disseminate itself in the traditional legal manner of dissimulation. He who knows how to govern knows how to dissimulate. He who does not know how to dissimulate cannot rule. Famous maxim, picked up by Machiavelli, but we find it in Putnam, we find it in the English lawyers much earlier. So you have to be able to dissimulate, and in dissimulating you have to be able to show, but in showing you show much more than is actually visible. You show what cannot be seen. That is the definition of legal dogma, according to Pierre Legendre. And I think it's a great point. Definition of legal dogma is of images. Images are dogmas, dogmas are images. These are visions. Whether you treat dogma as textual or visual, the dogmatic figure is a vision of how to behave, how to proceed, how to live according to the norm. Let me give you two other examples. One, the very beginning of Coke's Institutes. Cook's Institutes, for the English amongst you. They pronounce it Cook, because he's a great chef rather than a lawyer, but that's a different point. So Sir Edward Coke, the first part of the Institutes of the Laws of England, which is a commentary upon Littleton, not the name of a man only, but the name of the law itself is the subtitle, because they used to have decent subtitles as opposed to colons and academic chicanery. So how does he begin? He begins by saying, if you want to see the image of Littleton, this great man, then you need to go to the churches of Hinckley and Frankley in Leicestershire, just below Birmingham. And there you will find in the stained glass a portrait of Littleton. If you stare long enough at his portrait, if you stay sufficiently focused upon the visual line, you will see beyond the portraiture the man himself, the author of this work, the reason and the judgment that will help you become a better person, a nobler lawyer, a greater and more just person. But he has this notion of visual lines from visio. These are sight lines, but sight lines that lead you beyond what's there. And an image that doesn't lead you beyond what's there is no image at all. An image is there to evaporate. Point that is made very well in the Reformation debates about aerial images. What if I make the cross, sign of the cross in the air? Is that as idolatrous as a wooden crucifix? And the answer is it's more idolatrous because it leads quicker from the image to the thing signified. Ab imagine ad rem significatem. And they have wondrous debates around such figures. But the bottom line, if there are visual lines, if visual lines can help us to perceive and understand what's not there, what we will see is dogma, because dogma is precisely vision. It's image that has evaporated, or in Benjamin's upturning of it, it's an idea that is evaporated into an image. But for the lawyers, it's the upside down of that. So it's teaching dogma, and it's teaching what is technically mystery. It's teaching a theological regimen animarum. It's teaching access to the passage towards governance of the soul. Regimen animarum, regimen hominum, being more or less cognate. The state has to become a nursing father, according to the early moderns. The state has to govern the soul. And governing the soul is not a matter of law, it's a matter of dressing up in robes and presenting an occasion, inventing an event, and conveying an object of affect and an occasion of love. And if you look at the early law books, if you look at Fortescutus Illustratus by Edward Whitehouse, which is an incredible book, at one point he says, the study of law is a harmless trepanning. Trepanning is the Victorian, but obviously this predates it. You drill a hole in the head and you relieve the phantasms inside. So study of law is a harmless trepanning. We've got to fill them up with different images. So we drill a hole, we let them out, we put them in. So anyway, he's very clear that the maxims of common law, the basic articles of faith, the catechism of the lawyer, is concerned with mysteries that cannot be inquired into. These are artifacts of nature. These are moments of the fingerpost. These are divine ordinations. These are things that you can find on the ground if you look hard enough, if Mercury is driving you. And so Doddridge, for instance, says authority is much more important than reason in the study of law. And similarly, we find in Fortescue that maxims have no beyond, quoad non ultra. You cannot go beyond. There's a certain limit point, and that limit point is the moment of dogma or of maxim, and the moment of maxim is the moment where we encounter something that is not to be questioned, but that is expressly to be adored. And it's adoration that is possible through images, not possible through dry and dirty texts. So then we get a perhaps closer sense of what it is that the imagery is most directly doing. We have here the Corpus Juris Civilis, and at the time of the emblem tradition, you'd find that the legal texts were full of pictures, and you find that these pictures are fascinatingly dissonant with the text. In other words, you shouldn't read them ad similia, you should read them ad apparentiam. You should go from image to image. It tells a very different story, but here we have a fairly common one. This is In nomine Domini Nostri Jesu Christu. It's the image of Justinian on a pedestal, on a throne, with the theatrical curtain behind him, signaling the passage from one space to another. Justarii, look at the hand. In the various chironomias, which are the handbooks on Lex Gestus, on how you gesture, you'll see this is number 37. It's donation and it's silence. It's exordium and it is bequest. And the emperor, who has his rod of office on this side, is handing down Justarii, and then they are audiendo and scribendo. They're listening and writing. He gives, they write. That's how the law passes. That's what people in robes on benches in august settings such as these live to do. And here in Arnaud's Jurisprudentia, which was an intriguing book because it was his attempt to get a job in a law school back in the day, he wrote the book praising all of the burghers of Bourges, it was. But the child is asking, where do I come from? You know, do I come from that old goat sitting by the tree, the old man, yeah, my father? Or do I come from that rather frightening-looking woman lying on Mother Earth? No, says the astronomer, and he's the person to ask. You come from that spectral floating Justitia, who you'll notice, perfectly good eyes and a nice hand with the scales. You come from her. She is your origin. These are simply your temporary and earthly bearers. And Anno's Jurisprudentia is the most extraordinary book because of the number of emblemata that it has in it. And then, to give you a slightly later example, I love this one as an image of common law, of where we come from and how we cannot intervene. Here we have an image of custom as second nature, which is basically the definition of common law. And you see the generoso outside of the city. No arms, not even no hands. And he's writing with his right foot. Can you see that? So it's a sesquipedalian law because he's writing with one foot. It's a very bad joke, I apologize. But there's a second plume there and the left foot could write. So a foot and a half in Horace's terms. A nod to whoever it was. It was Jill who was talking about Horace earlier. And then you see Fortuna, the boat, and you see this indication of the spiritual from the tower ascending into the heavens, and it will normally be in this somewhat spectral ghostly form of ascension, but that is the passage, the Via Regia to heaven. So there you see how it is that we must come to learn. And the enterprise itself, you have any number of these, but Ad Omnia and Bracton, quod omnes tangit. Law has to touch all. Law has to have an avenue to everybody. And if you have to have an avenue to everybody, can't use words because Babel screwed that up. Everybody speaks different languages, Quebecois, French, Montréalese, who knows? Nobody understands anybody else. Even in Latin, they never had any idea what they were talking about if you read the relevant studies, which is why they generally didn't talk Latin. And Ad Omnia is just one version. Look at the divine hands, yeah? Which will be passing the pens. Yeah, the moving figure, the moving finger wrote, and having writ, not all your tears could wash away. One line, one word, whatever. So Ad Omnia, this representation of something that has to be able to get to all, and that is the purpose and nature of the vision. And this again, Chasseneuse, a lawyer, 1572, just if you want to understand the way in which this works, you have to understand, here is ideologia. Here is scientia legalis, here is scientia canonica. The top three, the trinity at the very top. In visual terms, you read from top left, well, top right, but looking at it top left, to bottom left, bottom right in your eyes. Bottom right, astronomia. And then scientia legalis is connected directly to music. So what is the purpose here? The purpose is to reproduce the symbol as that which does what it says. The symbol as a radical accomplishment of governance. So that the lawyers do with the rhythm of the norm what the ideologists, which is ideologia translates as doctrine, do in relation to the music of the spheres. And it's that connection that we can see here in Bonitius again. Note the passage to the heavens behind this fairly common symbol. The clouds represent death, then the arms coming out are divine, manifestations of divinity, and the sheet or the curtain is the representation of that moment of passage from one space to another. The moment of mystery being the moment when the theological, when that which has no being and is not, manifests in the temporal. And here you have a second version of it in the sense that, and we know the king's two bodies and so on fairly well, but here you have a very pissed off looking skeletal death having narrowly missed the crown, which is now triumphant and inhabiting the heavens, having won. But behind it, we have this notion of the soul, of something more than, something that has to pass through this sheet, this frame. And we see it again in Pia Desiderius. The temptation here, anima hominis, would be to see these pixelations on this sheet as some kind of capture. The soul as a pixelated or dusty interior to what is represented, if you look closely, as what appears to be a rib cage. This is inside the body. And what you have to realize is that theologically that is actually not the case. It's outside the body. It's about release. It's about passage ad infinitum. And here you can see, well, you're sitting so far away you can't, but you can see that she's in felix ego, unhappy me, I'm still in my body. And here you can see the soul and the soul trying to get to the angelological, which lurks behind the curtain, behind the veil of human misery, and so on and so on. Who can say more? Then we have the comfort of imagery. Just before I leave this, what is it that you want to instill in the soul? What is this harmless trepanning trying to do? And I've dealt with this many times in different forms, but here, I love this one, the castle of justice. Yeah, every Englishman's home is his castle. Here we see it, not simply his castle, it's turis justitiae. And you see that the foundation is true faith and caritas. Spes are the steps. And then fortitudo and prudentia is basically a homonym for law, are the portals. And when you get through those portals, then you get to the turris, you get to PAX, you get to peace, you get to a moment of repose. So there we have images that recur and recur, that repeat and repeat. And I'm suggesting that in a somewhat untutored sense, the students who believe that the judge on the throne who handed down the decision was more just and of greater legal authority are affectively returning to certain archetypes, certain visual unconscious inculcations that you will see on the walls of law schools, that you will see in the textbooks, that you will see in the literature, that you will see in the movies, that you will see, you know, even in Legally Blonde, you couldn't have a more wonderful depiction of Socratic terror than Elle Woods faces in her first class. She gets thrown out for not preparing. Okay, and for being weirdly dressed. So there are affective images that lawyers have to attach to. These are the basic dogmas, that which cannot not be done. And those form an unconscious. D.D. Huberman has written about it nicely in a book on Abby Warburg and Abby Warburg's theory of the progression of and the repetition of symbols. But what survives longest in a culture is what is most obscure, most hidden, most repressed. What is least visible, because nobody bothers to erase what can't be seen. And here we have these prior images, these precedentes, these orders of honor, effectively, that inhabit a spectral space below the surface of legal consciousness. So I just want to go to some modern versions drawn from the detritus that goes around law schools on the web, selling the school every day, a box full in any decent law school, and mine's only half decent, of glossy brochures and beautiful pictures of the latest decanal appointments, the latest hires, the latest visiting speakers, you name it. So these can form in an unerring and eerie way to this tradition. And my other example would be Antonio Di Giorgio's hand gestures in classical Greece and in modern Naples. He was writing in 1853. But his study showed, and it was the first one to do it, and Didi Huberman is repeating in a sense, hand gestures have remained invariant. Lex gestus. When Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court Justice, came out and gave the finger to the journalists, that's in Di Giorgio, digitum impudicum, and the Greeks would have recognized it as well. In other words, it simply doesn't change. So here we have Magister Ludi himself. This is from the genre of portraits of deans, which I love. I don't have time to say much about it. Called Sexton. Monsieur Sexton. Okay. He came to New York University Law School, the school with which I began, at a time when it was a decent commuter school. It was ranked number 30, horribile dictu, in the US News and World Report. That means everything in America. I don't know if it means anything to you in Canada, but take my word for it. I'm English, so I'm just reporting, not commenting. So he catapulted it to number 5, number 6 law school. And here is his portrait. Now, Sexton is the warden of the treasures of the church. He's the guardian of the wealth of the community. But you have this picture of him, and I photographed it myself, and you have to give me some credit for getting the flash on his progenitive area. So this shows you the eminence emanating in the manner that it should. Look at him leaning forward. This is chironomically number 52. This is the invocation of sanctity. So the fingers up towards the divinity and the finger grapes pointing slightly back. So clutching and proclaiming. And this is classically the sign of theological beneficence. He's leaning over a podium, and this is a classic trope in legal portraiture. White pages, virgin pages upon which ink has yet to be spilled. This is terra incognita. This is the unwritten legislation. And where is it for? Well, it's Gregorian in its scope. He's a Catholic, so it should be, but the relevant maxim from the 13th century, he is going to remake the whole world. And you can see it right there. There it is, underneath him, below, ready to be remade, the globe. Then outside, just in case you have any doubt, the curtain's drawn, so the play has begun. He can see out. Remember, Justitia and Brandt couldn't see out. She's blindfolded, but the window was unblindfolded. And outside, if you look hard, the Arc de Triomphe. There is Washington Square's monument to triumph that is outside of the window. So all in all, you could not get a better representation. But at the same time, it is the most classical of representations. And here you have the origin in an English legal emblem book. The sovereign should stand on the globe with its proper hieroglyphic figures, but it's basically blank. An eye in the chest, but the book to the stars, to astronomy, and then the rod of office, while the astronomers themselves are unable to do what the sovereign does. And then the maxim is that the wise sovereign can understand and so rule the stars. But the point is that they are in relation to the astronomic. They are engaged as much in ideologia, in doctrine, in other words, as they are in scientia legalis. And here you have a similar version of the same thing, putting the world together again, standing on an orb and placing two parts of the moon back in their proper place. Now my favorite. This is the New York Law School Alumni Magazine for autumn, not fall, for autumn of 2005. This is the cover, Dworkin on Dworkin. Well, look at that picture, if you please. Moses appearing from the rushes. You couldn't get a better representation. In nature, luxuriant, part of, indeed, definitive of, the gravity of judgment and the profundity of natural law that he alone can properly explain to you. Appreciate next his left hand. pointed down, index finger towards the ground, diffidentiam noto in the Chironomic Treatise, meaning pointing to a greater law that he alone is equipped to explain and interpret. And should you have any doubt, I'll go to the next image of him, actually, if it will oblige. Oh, we've blown up. Yeah, he turns into an angel, all in white. Yeah? So that's the same day. And he's now the transcendent lawyer. So he's gone beyond the sheet, the curtain, the frame. He is now with the divine. But if you wanted to adopt a slightly more satirical view, this is Cousteau again. That left hand, that diffidentiam noto, that desire, is the sign of the oracle. And here in Statuam Memnosis in Ethiopia, against the advocates, in the darkness you do not see the hand. In the darkness you do not see the oracle. But when the sun's rays emerge and you see them here, then you see the pedestal, you see the prominence, but you see a huge hand, a disproportionately large left hand. What does it mean? And it's in that same position of diffidentiam noto. And the answer is that it indicates an attorney or lawyer who is too keen on aggrandizing themselves, who wants to bask in the rays of the sun, who wants the gold that the sun conveys, whose hand grows large. The hand should be here. The finger should be the sign of Hippocrates, of silentium, of proper study. But it's not. The hand has wandered, and the wandering hand leads, I fear, to cupidity and to lust and to venal greeds. So that's the point of that. Here you can see that if you want to be kinder to the transcendent lawyer, this is from Qatari. Took me a long time to find this, but here is justice in two forms, as violence and justice as measure. Violence beating up whoever this poor individual is. But at the very bottom left of the picture, you see a hand truncated, and that is the indicia of justice, the finger post itself. In other words, a hand, and it's a left hand that is the point of transmission. And so there, the transcendent lawyer, and I have no idea how long I was supposed to talk, but anyway, I won't go on too long. As Henry VIII said, I won't detain you too long. Here we have the crowning glory of the piece. Here is Dworkin on his yacht, in his whiteness, yeah? Greater than fortune can ever harm. This is Gubernator Regni. This is someone commanding fortune in the same manner as the king is commanding fortune here. Rod of office, bearing the wind to their own purposes. And while he is at the helm, we have nothing to fear, is the basic meaning of the motto. And here you can see those who make their own fortune. And there is Fortuna, sails gathering the wind, and there is an anvil with which we humans must make our own fate. So Fortuna again, and then finally, because I have to be even-handed, Audi alteram partem and all of this, this is upon his appointment to a chair in general jurisprudence, whatever that is. I guess it's the opposite of particular jurisprudence. Duncan Kennedy, the priest of a movement that never happened, the leader of the critical legal studies contingent. And this is the Harvard Alumni Magazine, and just look at this. You've got the screen behind, so this is a man who is close to the gods. You have Veritas on the chair, but he's hiding half of the chair, making the pie sign. So this guy is basically genius. And then that old, old image of the blindfold, yeah? Hey, don't look at me. I'll look at you. So that's Duncan Kennedy, and there's quite a funny text with it about how he'll change the world and reform everything. And so the point is that the blindfold represents an exclusion. The blindfold represents a lack of knowledge. The blindfold is something that has to be studied. And that is why ingenio, wit, is following enigma. Enigma has shackles on her feet. Enigma cannot get away. But enigma has to be studied, followed, and understood, because enigma refers to something that we have forgotten. Enigma refers to something that has not been recovered. That's the definition in Quintilian. That's the definition in the Enigmata Iuris. And for our purposes, the enigma is the image, and the enigma belongs within Economos and Oikonomos. Economy being ecclesiastical and oikonomy being governance, disposition, and regulation of the soul. Until we understand how the images work, until we understand how to reconstruct that history, such is my thesis, right or wrong, and I have no fear of being wrong, then we will not fully comprehend how and why it is that students confronted with men in robes in fancy buildings with pretty pictures viewed it as being so much more serious, so much more effective, so much more persuasive, and so much more juridical than just being in front of lame professors such as you or I. Thank you. Well, it's very late, so should we go home? Go ahead, sorry.
No, I'll be quick, I promise. But the images the emblemata that you showed with the recurrent image, the very first ones, with the recurrent image of the blindfolded judge, reminds me a lot of these elements, which is, I think, problematic, which is the concomitance of the Inquisition during the same age. And the fact that this idea of having the people of the law being similar to prophets and therefore blindfolded as prophets would have allowed even a public that was knowledgeable, like the public of somebody who was studying law, to excuse them or to even understand them for taking positions against heretics or against witches, which were problematic, rationally speaking. So I'm asking, and it goes in parallel with another thing which I found extremely interesting. Your analysis points out of how, in the same period, the elements of the visual element is recurring in not only in emblemata but in all of the iconography of the legal, and in the vast majority of, at least in the Italian context of the Inquisition of the same time. One of the typical examples that are made in most of the trials, I think, for example, of the trials of Triora, which is in Liguria, and the entire population of this tiny village was basically killed of women just, you know, during the worst period of the Italian Inquisition, refers to the lawyer being asked to deal with the witch, being told never to look into her eyes, because those eyes would be the eyes that would betray and seduce him. So that the vision and the idea of being blindfolded would imply also the way in which the legal system would have to physically deal with the witch and the heretic. So I'm wondering if in the iconography of the blindfolded judge and the blindfolded legal system as being correct, there's nothing that may be also be linked with, we are prophetic, we know what you cannot know, outside of the legal system, which is intertwined at the same time with the whole religious environment that allows the Inquisition to happen, and therefore we're justified. So any of the decisions that may be taken while burning a witch are justifiable by this blindfoldedness that is prophetic and therefore cannot be judged. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. So the point of the trial as liturgy is to induce people into a world that isn't there. And there's actually some very interesting iconography and emblematization of keeping women out. Carfania in the Digest isn't allowed into court, and children aren't allowed into court, and you have the left hand of the judge usually pointing to, sometimes actually touching the woman's genitals, because that is where all evil, you know, where nothing lies. Yes, in a very direct sense, but in a less direct sense, and I cannot tire of this particular theme, the whole point of the Notitia Dignitatum, the whole point of the titles of honor and the system of precedence is to teach a hierarchy. And it's very explicit in all of the juridical. Domini Nostri, Justinian is Christ, no question. And they are simply the mediums through which the law emerges. So your question about the blindfold strikes me as very apposite, because everybody reads it as impartiality, but it's nothing to do with impartiality. It's to do with exclusion and to do with separating spheres. So you have a class of people who don't look. Bartolus, not looking, yeah? Chop your head off, you know, I won't have any feelings about that. The affect has been removed because, you know, there's no bond, there's no rope coming out of the eye and dragging me towards this or having any kind of sympathy for it. But around this time, the lawyers were generally also trained in the priesthood. So there's, you know, it's utrumque ius. It's one law and the other. They're both there, and the lawyers are priests, and the priests are lawyers, because what does a priest do except give you, pass on the laws whereby you should live? So the dogmata, historically, are the apostolic dogmata, and that's what is then transmitted into the legal tradition. And praecedentes is the word that's used in the early text. So precedents are presidents. Precedents are princes. Precedent is a person, and precedence is giving proper honor and respect and obeisance to those who tell you, you know, how human governance should occur or whatever it may be. So they are expressed even in Cook and people like that. They're sacerdotes, they're priests, they're periti. There are a whole range of expressions that explain how they're there to carry out the work of the divine. And should it be the pontiff's desire to rid the world of women, then so be it. That desire must be given effect, because that desire comes from someone who has no being and is not, and therefore cannot be either seen or challenged. So that's a yes. Yeah, Paul.
Is there evidence of parodic or ironic revisions of this massive visual culture from, I'm thinking, of course, of law students who are not only trainable but also resistant. I was set to think of this about by the picture of the yachted Dworkin, which invites, it's already,
parody,
it's actually already parody.
Sadly, none in these harsh economic times, but no, I mean, one of my interests in this has been to look at the tradition of satirical legal studies, and there is a very rich tradition, including in the American 20th century, the legal realists, hilarious at points, really wonderful. But these are sort of traditions of scholarly criticism, which you find in the critical legal studies movement as well. The Lizard, if you've ever read it, remarkable work, and included and led to some cartoons in Law Review footnotes, even sort of sometimes the text falling into the footnote in sort of the mid-80s, something like that. So little hints, but students themselves... It's a really complex question, and going back to the previous question, whose name I'm momentarily forgetting, Harvard Law Review publishes episodically or sporadically the Harvard Law Review, which is a satirical version, generally not very funny, but when Mary Jo Frug was murdered, there was a huge fight on the board of the Harvard Law Review. And Law Reviews in the States are student-edited. It's about the most insane kind of academic institution I've ever come across. But I think you probably have some version of it in Canada, those of you who are law professors may know of. Anyway, they have this review. And in the review proper, they had a huge fight because there was an article submitted posthumously by Mary Jo Frug's estate to the Law Review, and they voted 7-6 to publish it. And the conservative students were furious, and the conservative students developed a review that year, which was published and handed round at the Law Review dinner, in which the lead article, very lengthy article, was by Mary Jo Frug, the rigor mortis professor of law at Western New England Law School, and was entitled, "What Does a Girl Have to Do to Get into Harvard Law Review?" So it's kind of almost exactly your point. Total erasure. And the only other feature was that her article had been on postmodernism and justice, which also had its own kind of load and baggage. So one of the curious features, it would seem to me, of student-edited law reviews is that it seems to diminish rather than to expand the diversity of law reviews. The very, very conventional, and Mark could help me out here, but my experience is there's much less experimentation. The students want to impress the professors, and therefore they choose what they think is either most like the professor or is most likely to impress the professor. And so it's only very occasionally that weird and wonderful things creep into American top-tier U.S. law reviews. And then it's by accident because the students don't understand it. I regularly use a Latin title, and that scares the hell out of them. And that's one avenue in. But it's not really scholarly discourse. It's sort of a twilight zone of its very own making. So my answer is no.
Are there other questions, comments? Objections, castigations, a desire to dance, a hug perhaps? No?
We can line up.
So let me say, no. The filmmaker Stanley Kubrick said that there is no discussion that cannot be improved by lopping off 5 minutes.
So we've done well.
Okay.
Thank you for being here.
Yes, stamina or what?